Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Landon Mayer, and he'll be answering your most important questions on trout tips. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're going to be broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Landon a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to the website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Landon Mayer about his Pro Guide Trout Tips. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on guide, gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. Before we introduce Landon, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered for the drawing yet, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Landon's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Landon's latest book, Trout Tips, courtesy of Stackpole Books. So here's how you can win that book. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question is going to be about something that Landon and I talk about during the show. So you submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll win Landon's book. Tonight our guest is Landon Mayer. With 19 years of experience as a professional guide, Landon's success in catching trout is fueled by an addiction to pursuing large trout with small flies and lightweight fly fishing equipment. Landon enthusiastically teaches and demonstrates his techniques and on-river knowledge to fellow anglers and has developed innovative strategies for sighting, hooking, and landing selective trout. He shared these tips and secrets in his books, Colorado Best Fly Fishing, Sight Fishing for Trout, and How to Catch the Biggest Trout of Your Life. In addition to the two DVDs, Landing the Trout of Your Life and Weapons of Mass Fastest Production, both which also feature John Barr. Landon's passion for fly fishing has allowed him to make several noteworthy contributions to the sport. Among them is appearances as the headliner in international sports exposition shows at each of their shows in four states for 5 years, from 2008 to 2013. Landon travels to fly fishing-related organizations in regions in the Mid-Atlantic, West, Pacific Northwest, Southwest, and Southern states, teaching through guided trips, fly fishing classes, presentations, and demonstrations of his techniques. Landon is a contributing writer for Fly Fisherman and High Country Angler magazines, and his contributions have also been featured in publications such as Field and Stream, Fly Rod and Reel, American Angler, Southwest Fly Fishing, and Fishing and Fly magazines. As an ambassador in the fly fishing industry, Landon represents several lines, including Sims Fly Fishing Apparel, and is a royalty fly designer for Umqua Feather Merchants. He is also an advisory team member of Sims, Ross, Scientific Angler, Smith Optics, Fish Pond, and Casio Pro-Tech watches. Landon has been guiding in Colorado on the South Platte for the past 19 years. Landon, that's quite a story about you. Welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate the introduction, and it's great to be back and looking forward to answering some questions on the show.
Yeah, we got a lot of questions today, so it's going to be fun. And your new book was just incredible with all the tips you have provided in there. And we're going to kind of base our format of questions on the book. In other words, I've broken out, I've taken the chapters of your book, and then I've put the questions that the people have asked and dropped them into your chapter headings. And so that will give us a good start. And, of course, we expect you to give away your really good secrets tonight in some of the sections.
That's perfect. That's perfect.
Only the ones the guide knows, right?
You know, that's right. So, that's right.
Because we always catch more fish with a guide for some reason, and I don't know what that is. But there's something. You guys
on
are hiding
days, something. On good days.
On good days. Okay. Okay.
That's right.
Well, let's see what we got here.
Okay.
And I want to get, hold on just a second here. Let me get my Q&A up here because we will, yep, there's already some questions coming in. Oh, well, this is probably not in the book, but this is a pretty good question to start out since I just brought that up. Coy in Loveland, Colorado wrote in here just a minute ago, what are the most important characteristics of a good fly fishing guide?
You know, I think the,
huh?
that's very appropriate, and it's a great question as well. Thanks for submitting that. One of the biggest things I think when you start guiding, especially when you're on the water full time with various anglers, is believe in the sport of giving back. Every trip that I do, I really do concentrate on making it the best day for the angler at that time, and I am a firm believer of learning catching experiences on the water. That helps the angler grow, helps us both learn, and when you're guiding, patience is a virtue. It's key in every walk and every make that you do on different watersheds. So definitely patience, enjoying being out with various anglers, and understand that everybody needs to learn and there's a starting point, and you can never can know too much in this industry.
Yeah, yeah. And what, you know, and we all use guides around the world, really, when we go out and fish, and I'm sure you do too.
Absolutely.
When you go to new places. Yeah. What is it? Are there any particular questions you might ask, you know, if you're trying to kind of sort out whether this guide is going to be the right one for you? Are there any quick questions that you would ask?
Some of the questions I ask is what they're willing to do for the trip. Some people want to go out and just catch fish, and I think the biggest response that I look for first and foremost is the guide asking me what I would like to get out of the day and what's going to make it a successful day for myself. And once I hear that from a guide, I really go in and, you know, enjoy the trip and enjoy our day together. And I think that's very important for people to realize when they take a trip that it really is a chance to motivate yourself and understanding that you'll learn so much more in one day. It could be the comparison of what might take, you know, 6 months to learn. So it's really, it's a great experience all the way around.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point because expectations are everything, right? I mean, like you say, you could go out and you could say, you know, I want to go out today and I want to catch a trophy fish. I don't care how many fish I catch. I just want a trophy fish. And that
right.
changes the whole layout of the day, I would assume. Or I want to catch a lot of fish. Or I just want to learn how to cast better and present better. And that really kind of guides you as a guide to
Absolutely.
What to deliver. Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Well, let's jump in here. So
okay.
Your latest book, 101 Trout Tips, A Guide, Secrets, Tactics, and Techniques. So you broke the book out into many chapters here, and the first one is fly selection, and we did get some questions in about fly selection.
Sure.
One from Pete in St. Charles, Missouri, and Pete wrote in and he says, you recommended a size number 2 slump buster in your first book. That's a Kelly Gallup fly, isn't it?
Slump buster, that's a John Barr pattern.
Oh, that's a John Barr pattern, okay. In your first book and has really increased the size of the trout I have caught. Have you had any recent success with other streamer patterns?
Absolutely. Yeah, the slump buster is a great imitation. I use that many times to mimic and match smaller fry or trout within the watershed. So it's one to stick with. Other patterns that I've used in the last, I'd say, 5 years successfully is Lawson's Conehead Sculpin, and about the same size in number 2. It's a nice representation of a sculpin and olive, and you can mix and match that with other colors like tan, and it mimics and matches a smaller brown trout. Another good pattern is John Barr's Meat Whistle, which I use exclusively for crayfish imitations on whether it's still water or moving water in rivers. That's another wonderful pattern that you can use, and it's tied on a jig hook to where you can bounce it on the bottom without snagging. And another one I've become a fan of over the last few years is Charlie Craven's Dirty Hippie, which is a great imitation with a slim profile and really aggressive when it moves through the water with great action as well.
That's a new one.
Yeah, that's
Dirty
a great spot.
Dirty hippie, huh?
Dirty hippie. Okay. And one of the things I think that's important to realize about streamers, I always teach anglers, there's two types of streamers, natural and an attractor. A natural streamer has a slim profile and is more productive in low, clear water. In higher water where trout have cover from stained water or they have cover from storms moving in, I also use the tractor patterns, which have materials hanging off the sides, whether it's rubber legs or hackles. So always carry both in your box to attract and also match the natural.
Great, great. Another question from Brian Adams in Bakersfield, California. He says, common question for everybody we have on the show is, what's your go-to fly with size and color? Is there, do you have a fallback, you know, fly, nymph, whatever, that you always go to?
Absolutely. There's actually three. They're pretty common flies. Many people know about them, but a pheasant tail, of course, you could use that. Great example of how versatile that fly is you could use
right.
it in size 20 or 22 during the winter, and it's still going to be productive all the way through spring and summer. A hare's ear, another standard great go-to pattern, but I would say day in and day out on the water, if I'm struggling with imitations to match the naturals and I'm trying to get the fish to take, I always fall back on a red copper john, and sizes varying from 12 all the way down to 22. I think it mimics and represents the natural silhouette of a bug, but it also adds the feature of red. And red as an attractant color for every season of the year is just one of the best to go to all the time on various waterways.
Cool, cool. Yep, two of those. You know, I just remember going back to when I was a kid using hare's ear, and I still use it today. It's a good old standard, isn't it?
It absolutely is.
Yeah. Just looks like a bug. That's the important
it
thing.
It does.
Tom Scott in Denver wrote in, and he says, when you are hunting orange and yellow alligators with your clients on the South Platte, are you using streamers?
I love that question, and thanks for submitting that. They do look like yellow and orange alligators, the big males with the sticking out and flared pectoral fins, so it's always fun to hunt those. And it's a great question. For every trip that I do, my goal during the trip is to try to use 2 to 3 disciplines with my clients. And the reason for that is you learn more in the water with me. Secondly, if you run through certain waterways or pockets, pools, and runs only using one discipline, you could miss out on larger fish like the browns. And streamers, I would say 50% of the trips I do in the fall, I use streamers, and I base that exclusively on light conditions. And I'm a huge fan of always using the term that dark water delivers. And dark water deliveries are based on high flows, time of day, and storm systems moving in. So when I go through a run in the morning, if it's clear skies, I'll usually come back to that same run in the afternoon when some of the storms move in or the sun begins to get close to setting, and I know that those bigger browns are going to start to disperse and actively feed on the cover darkness.
Okay. Good. Now, his question, you know, was more specifically about streamers.
Mm-hmm.
And there was another, well, one just came in on the Internet here. It says, I thought big trout feed mostly on big prey such as minnows on the waters you fish. Is that not true? So, you know, do you catch more fish on streamers than midges as far as, you know, large trout?
No. I would say that the percentage of fish we land on streamers, honestly, is 25%. We do catch some of the larger fish on streamers because they are hunting bigger prey and they have a larger diet. But again, when you're doing that, just try to get used to using 2 or 3 disciplines and don't leave the water any day without throwing streamers and trying to really target that dark water and those solutions for finding fish when they have cover and they remain calm and safe. And larger trout in particular are very lazy by nature. They don't like to expend energy unless they receive the nutrients back. So that's why streamers can be productive. But they'll also adapt and adjust, and they constantly have to eat to maintain their size. So knowing that, they'll eat midges and a natural insect during a hatch midday, and then getting close to nightfall or if there's storms or the water increases and flows, they'll change their diet and start to exclusively look for those bait fish or the crayfish or the sculpin. So we do, on a daily basis, I would say during the fall, actively catch fish on streamers, but I really do try to target low light scenarios or dark water with the streamers, and I would say 25% safe, and some of the largest fish will definitely be caught on streamers if you put the time in.
Okay, okay. Jim Sebin, in St. Louis, Missouri, he says, I like to fish Missouri rivers, Merrimack, Current, 11 Point. He says, some days fish, and this happens on any river, some days fish won't take anything I throw to them. What flyer techniques do you recommend on these kind of days?
Great question, and we all experience these days, no matter how much an advanced angler you believe you are, how many years you have on the water. One of the things I've done in the last 10 years that has really produced is when I have selected trout that just simply won't take, it doesn't seem like the right conditions, I'll unmatch the hatch or throw something obnoxious to get their attention, and it's surprising how many fish will be willing to feed and come over and take that imitation we supply. Some of the best ways for this, an example in the fall, would be throwing hoppers or mice. During the spring months, throwing leeches when fish are midging. And then during the summer, just throwing something bigger than the hatch that's going on at that time, just so you get those fish to come over and at least investigate and look at taking the fly.
So change it up. Do something different.
Yeah, unmatch the hatch, just something out of the box, absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know if it was Einstein or whoever said, you know, definition of insanity is doing the same thing again and again,
yeah,
and expecting different results. And I guess that applies to fly fishing, right?
It does. We all get stuck in grooves, so don't be afraid to throw something and experiment, because that's how we all grow as anglers, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Norm in Dublin, Ireland wrote in, and he said, asked you to talk for a while about hook size. I don't know exactly what he meant by that, but I think it's hook size in relationship to the flies you're fishing is what I expect.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's a great question. What I believe he was getting at is what I've started doing is supplying hooks, a great example, hooks with strength, and Tiemco makes imitations or hooks for imitations like their 2488 Heavy, which is a curved-style scud hook that I use for midges. I like to increase the strength of the hook by adding the heavy element to it. And then I'll also tie smaller flies, like a size 20 betas. I'll tie that on a hook that's one size larger while I still keep the same length and silhouette size of the fly. And what that does is increases the hook gap and gives you more strength when you're fighting larger trout.
Okay, great. Let's move to chapter two here, which we got a lot of questions on. I'm actually surprised by this because you are so known for presentation and, you know, your techniques of great presentation. But your second chapter in the book was ready to rig, about rigging up and how you rig. So we got a ton of questions on this. So Mike Clark in Boiseville, New York wrote in, he says, do you prefer to tie your own leaders, use factory-made continuous tapered leaders, and or do you prefer to use furl leaders, and why?
It's a great question. Thanks for submitting that. I prefer using tapered leaders when I have a shorter distance on my rigs. For example, if my rig is going to be set up to where the leader is around 9 feet with the extension of flies, which is typically around 18 inches between flies for myself, I'll run with a standard tapered leader. If I'm needing more distance or I'm wanting to keep my fly line or anything unnatural away from wary trout, I'll actually cut a tapered leader, let's say 9 foot, for example. I'll cut it in the middle, and instead of running a tapered line down, I'll run a straight line from the cut leader, which is about, I would say, 4 to 4.5 feet left over. And if I'm using 5X, I'll cut it back and then connect 4X and then run that straight to my first fly. And the advantage of that is the thinner diameter throughout the tippet that you connect. It allows your flies to sink and gives you more distance for depth control. In reverse for dry flies, I think it allows you to land on the surface with less disturbance. And you can also, because the trout can distinguish between the smaller diameter like the can a tapered leader, you can get away with using heavier tippet sizes if you run that longer length from the midsection where you cut the standard tapered leader. smaller diameter, less resistance in the water, and quite honestly, you can drift the fish without them detecting it. So I'll do that for longer leader setups. And I've had many clients use ferrule leaders. I'm not as much of a fan myself. I just have so much confidence in fluorocarbon rigs that I'll typically set up myself. But I know in the past people have used those, especially for dry flies with the soft lay down on the surface, and found a lot of success with it as well.
Right. Andy asked specifically about what's your leader setup for nymphing.
Right.
Can you kind of be more specific about what you just talked about in that regard?
Absolutely. So when I'm nymphing, it's surprising to many anglers that I use a fairly standard setup for leaders. As I mentioned, if I need to extend, I'll run straight tippet size to my first fly from a leader cut off. And I don't use three-fly rigs. I'm a fan of two-fly or one-fly. I believe you foul hook less fish, you have more control and accuracy knowing where you're drifting. And most of my nymph setups are based on a tier system where I don't use split shot. I use the same diameter of a bead as I would shot on weighted flies. And when I'm doing that, using a small thingamabobber, clear or glow in the dark, everything in front of the trout is natural and not unnatural, which can cause them to spook. So most of it's two fly rigs separated by 18 inches between both flies. The other thing that I'll do is I will not drop my indicator below 4 feet. I'll keep it at general basis, the distance of 4 feet from my first fly. And the reason for that, I do a lot of tension nymphing with low rod positioning, so I want to make sure that the trout can't see the indicator. If I do drop my indicator below, I'll replace an indicator with a natural imitation of a food supply, like a hopper, a mouse, or a blueing olive, or a green drake, or something that's not going to spook the fish.
Okay, good. So you're fishing quite often with indicators then, is that true? Do you fish more often with that, or is that...
You know, I'll do 50-50. So 50% of the time, if the water's really clear and I can control my depth where I don't snag river bottom before my flies reach the fish's beam lane, I won't use an indicator. A lot of that's based on low water flows, bright sunny days to where they're going to spook, or even something landing on the surface that's going to cause the fish to become wary. When the flows are higher, on the way I look at indicators, I like to think of them as suspenders where I can suspend my fly, control the drift, and also use it as a tracking device to see where the flies are drifting and have an idea or generalization of where the flies are based on the trout's viewing lane. So I would say 50% of the time without and 50% of the time with. And if you haven't tried them, what's changed the game for nymphing is the clear and glow-in-the-dark thingamabobber. They look translucent when the fish are looking up at a 45-degree angle, and it mimics a dirty water bubble. Other indicators when the trout are looking up are contrast against the sky, so they create a shadow, and that's why the clear thingamabobbers allow you to drift the fish without them becoming spooked.
Cool. Good tip. The next question that came in was from Steve Bauer in Boise. Now, I don't know if you can add to this or not. He says, I often use the 9-foot 5X leader and then add 12 inches of 5X or 6X tippet. As the leader gets shortened, I start tying back on sections of 3, 4, 5X tippet to get back to the desired length. So he says, I just eyeball the remaining line diameter for the tippet size and estimate the added length. Is there some guidance to estimate how long each section should be so that you can get decent performance out of the knotted leader?
Yeah, you can. That's a great question, and thanks for submitting it. You can definitely cut back as you've been doing on your leader. The generalization, a lot of people will build their leaders when they set them up to where they have the strongest point connected to the fly line, almost mimicking the butt section, and then moving down to where they taper, and it can start out with 2 feet of something heavy, 8, 10, 12 pound, going down from there and mix and match your rig. But I usually do 2 feet heavy on the top end, and then the middle section I'll run 3 feet of something that's tapering down, probably 3 to 4X. Then from there I'll go 4X to 5X for the following 2 or 3 feet, and then 5X to 6X if I'm using an incredibly small rig. But one of the challenges I find with building a leader is the turnover is not always as great as it is with a tapered leader. But the second thing if I'm adjusting an indicator up and down on my rig, it becomes worrisome because you're dealing with so many connection knots, and you also lose some strength in the leader as well.
Okay, okay. And he said, also he had some other quote. He says, I use surgeon's knots with three turns, which seem to hold well. He says, use loop-to-loop. I guess he's asking, do you use loop-to-loop or always blood knot the leader onto the butt section?
For the leader onto the butt section, I use a blood knot, and then I coat it with UV knot sealer. And the reason for that, loop-to-loops, they can create a hinge, but the biggest challenge I find with a loop-to-loop is it could get stuck in the top guide when you're fighting the fish, especially in close quarters. And by doing the blood knot and applying the UV knot sealer, then you coat it so it's a smooth transition through the guide, and you get a little bit better turnover without worrying about a kink or a hinge.
And as far as the connecting knots for the leader and tippet, you use blood knots as well? I mean, surgeon's knots or blood knots?
Absolutely. I'm a huge fan of fluorocarbon, so I use triple surgeon's knot connecting the tippet to the leader. And then I use a clinch or cinch knot, and then I improve it to the first fly, to the bend of the first fly for the second piece of tippet, and then right to the eye of the hook for the second fly.
Okay. Okay, great. Great. Let's take a quick break here, Landon, and
okay.
I'll be back in about 30 seconds, and we'll continue on.
Sounds great.
Women's fly fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's fly fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's womensflyfishing.net. Or call Pudge at 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Landon Mayer about trout tips. If you'd like to ask Landon a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Landon, I always ask my guests at this point in the show, what's going on in your fly fishing world? Well, we know you just finished up this book. You want to tell us a little bit about the book and what else is happening in your world?
Absolutely, yeah. It's been a wonderful start to the year. We've had really warm weather, low flows right now, and clear skies with no wind, which is a treat. We're not used to that in the South Platte drainage here in Colorado. But the new book, 101 Trout Tips, just came out in January, and I've been traveling to various shows, the Fly Fishing Show, the International Sportsman's Expo, and have been in 13 different states in 2 months doing presentations and talks on the book and tying demos. And in addition to that, started guiding full-time again, and the book is basically a collection of 19 years of guide and journal notes put together, and it was really nice to revisit some of the thoughts and theories from the past, and a lot of the techniques and strategies in the book are unorthodox to where you may think you've been doing something the wrong way, but in return, you can find a use for it and some element within our sport. So it's really great to have the book out. Looking forward to going full speed on the water this year. I still guide 200 days a year and enjoy every day and all the people I get to experience it with. So it's been a wonderful kickstart to the year. I'm looking forward to the remaining.
Yeah, cool. Well, it's going to be an interesting year, that's for sure. I'm going to try to squeeze my last day of skiing in on Friday and
absolutely.
Hope there's some snow.
Absolutely.
But it's going fast, that's for sure. Yeah, now we got some whole pile of questions. This came in on the Internet. Some of them follow up. Okay, so let's knock a bunch of these off here, Landon, for the folks.
And yeah.
Bill, I guess he's in Austin, wrote in and he says, favorite knot to connect to the fly. Didn't you say that was improved clinch knot?
Yep, absolutely. Yep. Okay. I find confidence in that for sure.
Okay, and so there you go on that one, Bill, just for clarification. Treg in Moscow, Idaho asks, can you repeat your favorite streams? Did I miss something? Did you mention your favorite streams? Oh, probably the South Platte and the other ones you guide on? You want to tell people where you guide primarily?
Sure. Yeah, I guide primarily, exclusively full time on the South Platte. I do a few trips with various shops throughout the state, whether it be on the St. Vrain or the Yampa River and Steamboat. And quite honestly, I love the South Platte, and it's one of my favorite fisheries in the sense that we have so much public water and we deal with selective and wary trout, in addition to the fact that we get migration of tremendous fish in numbers and size that come in throughout the course of the year. The other advantage that other people have found out of the South Platte in particular is that every make of the tailwater, which there's five in its entirety, those five tailwaters look and flow differently, so it really does supply you so much knowledge because you have to adapt and adjust for every tailwater you experience, whether it's below Spinney on the Dream Stream, at Deckers, below Cheeseman, Waterton Canyon, 11 Mile Canyon, the list goes on. So that's one of my favorite, but I love traveling to so many various places to go out to selective trout. And last May, in fact, I went out to Pennsylvania and we had a chance to experience some of their spring creeks and tailwaters and use some of the techniques that we have back home in the west here out there in the east. And it was amazing how effective those techniques are on a lot of the various waterways on the east coast, like Spring Creek, Big Spring Creek, Delaware, and the Little Juniata River.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, they're transferable for sure.
But I would have to say real quick, too, that I think in our state of Colorado, my two favorite fisheries would have to be the Yampa River and the South Platte River, knowing that the South Platte has big populations of wild browns, and the Yampa River near Steamboat, Colorado, has large populations of wild rainbow trout. So they're both really great fisheries.
Where do you fish? What section of the Yampa do you fish up in Steamboat?
In town is very effective. I was just up presenting with Pat Dorsey 3 weeks ago, and we fished right next to 13th Street Bridge where the hot springs flow in. Yeah, had a wonderful day there. And I also fished below Stagecoach. I fished above Catamount Reservoir with great success, and also outside of Steamboat near Craig on some of the lease properties and public water in that excess as well.
Okay. Thomas Murphy in Redmond wrote in here on the Internet. He says, when unmatching the hatch, as you talked about earlier, do you also go to specific colors to get defensive behavioral strike, or does that not really seem to make a difference on tough days?
Great question. I do. I'll give you the example. If I switch to leeches with this time of year that we're dealing with, transferring from winter into spring, when we deal with the spring bite, a lot of times I'll use black because it's a permanent and dominant color as it's drifting through dirty or high water flow conditions. That's what I'll use in imitations for leeches. When I'm doing hoppers, I love using red as an attractor, especially knowing that a lot of hoppers have red on their underlegs. When I'm using mice, the color really doesn't matter so much for mice. It's more the silhouette and how low it rides in the film, and I'm a big fan of the Moorish mouse. And then for the fall season, I also love using the color green. Chartreuse green is a great color. I think a lot of big dominant brown trout, especially fish in river systems, really concentrate heavy on the caddis hatch and look for that color. So those are just some examples of unmatching the hatch where you get a response from color and fish can see them, and it really does trigger them to come over and attack.
Okay. Hope that helps. Sockeye Steve in Sweetwater wrote in, and on the Internet here, too, says, so you're fishing water like the upper Colorado, call it Gore Canyon. It says, bluebird skies, no clouds, blue-wing olives. The fish are starting to get some food in their bellies, a little like normal feed patterns. What are you going to throw at them, Landon, and why?
Great question. If they're going on the blueing olive bite, if they're subsurface conditions where they're close to the river bottom, standard flies like a pheasant tail or dark-colored copper john really work well. If I start seeing fish lifting, getting closer to the surface in a suspended state, I'll use my trailing flies in a merger and try to lift it up and drift it more in the mid-column. If they really start coming up and we start seeing fish actively rising on the surface, I'll start out with an adult imitation fairly similar to what most may use, a parachute at them as a dry. The fish become wary and selective. Instead of dropping something, I'll then switch to a cripple pattern, which is stuck in the shuck, I believe that trout, especially with betas and some of these other hatches, when they start to actively feed, will come up and trigger those. And then if need be, drop something below, a foot below the water surface, and drift it down to them. And when you're dealing with betas imitations in particular, I'm a huge fan of Craven's Juju Betas. It's one of my go-to standards for the emergence, or John Barr's Blowing Olive Flashback Emerger. So many good imitations out there. But I think one of the keys when you're dealing with hatches and looking at the trout's feeding behavior is try to make sure that you have the right water column. If they're on the bottom, present on the bottom, knowing that the foods typically are crawling. If they're mid-column, they're more apt to look up and take an emerger. And if they're right at the surface, just make sure that they feel safe in whatever they're going to feed on.
Okay. Okay, good. Good. Let's see what else we got here. A lot of questions coming in on the Internet. Okay. Bill in Austin, he says, if you were going to go hunting for a 30-plus inch trout in the lower 48, where would you go and when?
Good question. Ooh, that's a tough one too. I always, when people ask me about 30-inch trout, after guiding in Alaska on the Naknek River for 16 weeks, I always recommend Alaska if they're trying to obtain that goal, knowing that they have so many chances at bigger fish on the Naknek or the Kwijak and some of the other watersheds. I think Colorado in particular is known for larger trout, and the reason for that is we have such an abundance of crustaceans and protein-supplied food sources that the trout become very large. So the Taylor River is a good example of a place that you could go and obtain those fish, have a shot at least of knowing that there's fish around. The Truckee River is a great spot, California, with some of the larger fish. The South Fly River and our home waters here are great. And I think the thing to really look at is knowing if you're going to select a water system or a drainage, if it's going to have larger fish or even a still water, research the fishery itself and really look at their data that they have when it's available to see if there's populations of wild fish, the growth pattern, how fast they grow, how long they grow, and also, most importantly, the abundance of food source. So those are some examples, but there's great opportunities in Colorado, I would say, just generally speaking, of how many great fisheries we have that can have the opportunity of 30-plus inch fish.
Okay, great. Okay, let's get back to the ones that came in earlier. We're kind of back to ready to rig here. And you kind of answered Walt's question about to use drop shot when nymphing, and earlier you said you try to use weighted nymphs. Is that,
yes.
Did I catch that correct? Yeah, so I think we caught that one.
Yep.
Tom Scott in Denver wants to know how you rig when targeting trophy fish over 22 inches. Do you rig any differently?
You know, I would say the most common thing that I'll do when I'm dealing with larger fish is I usually will use 5X or larger for tippet. We will use 6X, but the challenge with 6X is not so much reaching the breaking point. It's honestly breaking the fish off because the tippet will touch their teeth, and then the hook or the pressure factor when you're trying to fight the trout. So I think it's shocking to some people that selective fish will take smaller flies on 5X as long as you're using fluorocarbon, and that might help in this question as well. Fluorocarbon leaders and tippet, non-reflecting of light and abrasion resistant, really do work very, very well. And the biggest thing about when you're delivering to a larger fish, especially over 22 inches, is just to make sure that everything appears natural. Always make sure you have fresh tippet on, and make sure that you also have extension between the flies when you need them, or decrease the length between the flies. If the fish are close to the surface actively feeding, I'll decrease the length. If they're further down in the column, I'll increase the length, knowing the trout have a chance to see both. But really that tier system of weighted flies over split shot and then hiding the indicator or not using the indicator with 5X or larger really does help your odds.
Okay, good. Good tips. And we address the next one about loop-to-loop. Another one about loop-to-loop. I think Landon told us there that, you know, the UV knot sealer, and it was blood knot, wasn't it?
It was blood knot. And you can use a loop-to-loop. Just make sure that typically the loop on the fly line is thin in profile and diameter. It's the leaders that have the larger loop. So if you need to clip that off, if you prefer a loop-to-loop, tie your own loop knot and then make sure it's small enough to where it's matching the diameter of the loop on the fly line. That way you get a smooth transfer, and when it seats correctly, it won't hinge the fly line as bad because you have the same diameter and less friction in the air when you're making the forward loop on the cast.
Okay, and the last thing you want is to have a trophy fish on and have something like that foul up your your line.
Once it happens, you'll never do it again.
Frank in Pennsylvania wrote in, and he says, I'm from Pennsylvania and fished Roaring Fork below Aspen last year. What a beautiful stream and a great pocket water. But the speed of the current and the depth of the pockets made it hard to get my rig deep enough. How do you set up your leader, and do you add weight to leader to use heavy or use heavy anchor flies, indicator or no indicator? So his particular challenge is deep pocket water trying to get down to those fish.
Absolutely, and great question, and also included an answer in that question as well. I'm a huge believer in not using drop shot, but using anchored flies. And an anchor fly, whether it be one of my favorites is the crane fly larva, or if you're using a large scud imitation or a large caddis imitation. When I mentioned earlier about the leader, where you cut the diameter down by literally building the leader halfway from 4 feet down from a standard tapered leader, the thinner diameter you have all the way down to your flies, less resistance in the water. So number one, that will help. Two, when you're using the anchor flies, make sure that there's enough depth in the sinking ratio to where you have various sizes ranging from 12 to 14 to 16 to 18. If need be, you can have two anchored flies where you're really getting down deep. And one of the standard casts that we all may have heard of, don't always use effectively, is the tuck cast. And when you're dealing with waterways where you're, like the Roaring Fork in particular, where you can get close to some of the edges or the pockets in the rocks, whether you're on a boat or you're standing in the water waiting around, a tuck cast, when you do that correctly using a large circle with your arm extended out in front of you, the first thing that lands on the water is your flies, which charges down and gives you a little bit more depth control. Once your flies sink to the determined depth, then use a tension, Czech-style or European-style nymphing where you're leading the flies with the rod tip at a 45-degree angle. That way you have tension, and you can drop or lift the flies based on what's on the river bottom.
Okay. Good tips. Ted in Massachusetts, again, talking about leaders. He says, I most often fish in lakes and ponds. Trying to figure out leaders and tippet types and lengths is difficult for both trout and bass. A general rule would be helpful. Is it different for you in lakes and ponds?
It is. I'm what a lot of people are surprised at when they do trips with me on the water is how much of a fan and passion I have for still waters. Some of the largest trout in the world are found in still waters because the last 2 years of their lives, when they don't want to migrate up a river system or moving water, you'll find those bigger fish in still waters. The biggest key to still waters is depth control. And once you find depth control, knowing that the trout in still states of waterways are in constant motion looking for their food, unlike river trout that are waiting for the current to supply them their meal, these moving fish will determine a depth and typically stay there. I would recommend extending your leaders where you have your flies separated by 3 to 4 feet. That way, every time you're hanging your flies below an indicator, it's at a different water column. The other tip that's in the book that you can use is marking your leaders for every 3 feet. Put a mark with a green or black permanent marker. So that way, when you lift your rod and you're looking at your leader after you hook a fish, you know exactly what depth you're at. And lastly, use slip indicators, because a slip indicator will allow you to hang your flies, sometimes exaggerated, down 35 feet. When the trout takes and you set the hook, the slip indicator will release, slip all the way down to your first fly, and that way you can fight that fish all the way to the net and don't have to worry about breaking it off.
Okay, good. And, yeah, you kind of move to another section. You do have a chapter on stillwater success.
Right.
In the book that deals just with tips on that alone. So, yeah, and I never thought of you as a stillwater fly fisherman.
I love it, yeah, I love it.
I guess just because you always have 1 foot in the South Platte, I guess that's the reason.
Yeah, in the South Platte, my home waters on the South Platte where I literally played as a kid and now worked full-time in my career is in South Park, and we have 11 Mile Canyon Reservoir, Spinney Reservoir, and then we also have Antero Reservoir, which they're draining this year to fix the dam. In addition to that, we have the Delaney Lakes, which are great in northern Colorado. So there's so many opportunities, and ice off is just around the corner here in the next week or two, so I'm excited to stick my feet in the cold water and look for those cruising fish.
Yeah, cool. Okay, let's take a quick break here, and then we'll come back and start talking about timing.
Excellent.
Timing, as you titled the chapter, timing is everything. So we'll come right back to that in just a minute. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. Or call Keeney's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. That's 1-800-400-0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Landon Mayer about trout tips. If you'd like to ask Landon a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So timing is everything. We did get a couple questions on that from Norm in Dublin, Ireland, and a lot of good stillwater fishing over in the British Isles, that's for sure. As well as streams.
Nice.
He says, would you please talk a while about time of day, light levels, and time of year, and how you approach this, how this plays a role in you catching fish?
Absolutely. In the book, it mentions this about timing, breaking down the season. It's the best way for me to explain this. In the winter and spring months, it's oftentimes the cold water warming, so the afternoon hours of the day are more productive because water temperatures increase. Rainbows, cutthroats, cutbows will actively start to move and feed as the water temperature increases for them. When I transition into the summer months, a lot of times during the summer, fish will actively feed based on the hatch and not worry as much about temperature. But when they're dealing with the hatch in specific, afterwards they can slow down. So I'll look for a lot of the dark waterways or dark water deliveries, and that oftentimes in the summer is going to come from dark skies. So the afternoon hours, the last 3 hours of the day is when some of those larger trout that have been feeding in the morning have rested and digested and start to actively feed. When you transfer into the fall months, just remember that it's the warm water cooling that the trout are looking for activity as far as the best water temperatures. Anywhere from 50 to 55 degrees, early morning, late afternoon, evening right at dusk, and even the nighttime hours, the first 3 hours in the evening, a lot of those larger browns will begin to actively feed. I always recommend to clients, too, when I'm on the water, if you approach a certain area of the fishery and the trout are being selective or wary because of high sun, don't give up on thinking you don't have a shot at that productive or big fish or big waterway. You can always come back to that location when it's ideal, whether it's low light or whether you're dealing with storms and dark skies or an increase in flow. And a lot of times when you have the lower light and the fish feel safe, that's when they're going to move about and start to actively feed.
Okay. Then Norm wrote in again, another question. He said, how are your catches of trophy trout spread throughout the year? Are they mixed evenly between the warmer and colder months, or predominantly one over the other?
That's a great question, and one that a lot of people should really pay attention to as far as temperature and when the fish move. So it's common for larger trout in the spring and the fall to migrate before they actively spawn. And I'm a huge, huge fan of making sure that we allow fish to naturally reproduce. Don't fish to spawning trout or fish on reds. Knowing that, the first 2 months before when the trout are known to spawn is when they're going to be in their pre-spawn state, where they stage up in deep runs and start to actively feed. So 2 months before spring, 2 months before fall. And when you're timing the temperatures, it's not always, what a lot of people are fooled of is believing that the higher the flow, the more the fish move and the more active the water is. That's not always the case, because a lot of trout, especially in tailwaters in Colorado, for example, they don't migrate monthly alone. They also migrate weekly, daily, and hourly. So the last few hours of the day is really some of your best and prime time to target those fish when they start to move. And for the summer season, look for the highest, dirtiest water you can, knowing that the peak and flow is going to increase the amount of food supply to the trout. Not to mention, they're also going to, the bigger fish will disperse because they feel safe. And when you're looking at water during the summer, just remember that trout need three things to survive. They need cover, oxygen, and food supply, and they need them in that order. And if the water supplies all of that, which dirty water does, then you're going to find a lot of actively feeding fish where other times they might be spooked or wary in the runs.
When you're talking about that, because that's kind of moving on to another one of Norm's questions,
sure.
Reading moving water, he asks about water height and color, and you just talked about that, dirty water.
Right.
But that then it goes, you know, how do you work with dirty water and trying to spot the trophy trout? You know.
You bet. Great question. So in high water and dirty water, a lot of times when the water's stained or off color, you're looking for objects of the trout's body. You're not looking for the whole entire silhouette or the detailed view. So my two favorite objects to try to identify is the top of the tail and the top of the dorsal fin, knowing that the tail is in constant movement and motion, whether it's holding in the river or swimming around on the still water. And many larger trout possess various color changes on their body, whether it's a blue back on the steelhead, or whether it's a dark tail on a brown or the bright coloration on a char. All these fish, when they move, will give you some identification in dirty water that they're holding. And lastly, when the water is dirty, a majority of the time the water is dirty from a spike in flow or something taking place. So a lot of those fish are pushed to the edges and literally can be 3 feet from the bank that you're standing on.
So that's when you can't see. And at times, you know, you can't see anything.
Right.
In my mind.
Exactly.
So that's when
exactly.
You move to the edges and start fishing the edges. Huh?
You do. And sight fishing isn't just always seeing the trout. It's also seeing water and where it could be productive. And on the edge of the river is great, looking for structure on the edges where the trout can hold and feel secure or have a break from the high-moving current, or areas where they can see, which a lot of times at the edge of the river, there's going to be spots and points where it's shallower, so the trout have more chances of seeing the next meal.
Great, great. Okay. And that moves into seeing is believing.
Yeah.
When we're talking about seeing fish. And Norm has another great question. He's just very
sure.
Prolific. So, how many exceptionally large trout that you have caught have you spotted before making the cast? I'm going to venture a guess here, Landon.
Sure.
I would say
sure.
Probably 90%.
It's close. It's
how close am I?
You're relatively close. The only times that I am not casting the trout that I can see is in dirty water scenarios, as we just mentioned, or when fish are moving around in low light. So I would say 75% of the time, trout have been spotted where you're making a presentation. Now, spotting the trout isn't always seeing the fish in the water and watching it take. A good example of this is when you're fishing for mice in the evening. Sometimes I'll look for wakes during the summer months where trout are moving about chasing their meal, and that wake on the surface at least lets me identify a location in the water where I can make a presentation with a mouse. Or when you're dealing with the evening bite, when you can't see if you're dealing with the red headlamp and retying or rigging, a lot of times sight fishing becomes beyond where you're also listening for the trout. You're waiting to hear if you see the gulping, the sucking motion and sound that the browns have on the surface. So 75% of the time you'll see them, but don't always believe it's a trout in the water. Sometimes it's something on the surface where they're nervous, or when you're skating the fly and it's interrupted by the rise form. But a lot of sight fishing has to do with just paying attention to beyond the river and just fishing beyond the water, trying to find the target itself.
Okay, great. Another chapter you have in the book is exceptional casting.
Yeah.
Andy Cordova wrote in from Albuquerque, and this is about teaching kids. I threw this in this section because I thought it was good. He says, teaching fly fishing to 12-year-olds is presenting a problem. We have a local pond with trout, and at this time of year with no surface feeding. I try to rig them up with a strike indicator, weight, and flies, but all those hinges on the leader, all they do is create a bird's nest due to their rudimentary casting skills. So do you have any suggestions on teaching kids?
Absolutely. It's a great question. I love to answer this. We have four children at home, my wife, Michelle, and I. So we love teaching youth and teaching our kiddos and really passing on and giving back to the sport for the next generation. And when you're dealing with children on the water, the best thing for them to understand a lot of times is using a reference for the cast, something that they may connect with. And one of my favorites of this is when you're explaining the casting stroke, the key to a productive cast is keeping the rod traveling in a straight plane. A lot of anglers in their youth, when they first start, have the tendency to roll their arm or break their wrist. So if you use the analogy of opening and closing the fridge door, that's almost the same stroke of a cast that a kid can relate to. The other thing is I would suggest putting an indicator on your rig, maybe not having dual flies or even weight. Have one weighted fly barbless with a strike indicator, and then if they're on a pond, have them pick the rod up to 12 o'clock, pause for a second, and then bring it back down water level to where they can feel the load, the pickup and lay down cast. And that, once they start feeling the load and seeing how the line moves, then they make the connection with the normal false casting stroke. So those two tips should help out as far as removing the bird's nest and getting more productivity out of the day.
Okay, good, good. You mentioned a broken wrist here a minute ago.
Yes.
And in your section on exceptional casting, you have a one segment on casting from a broken wrist. Can you explain that to us?
Absolutely. So this goes right to the point of the book, and that is where a broken wrist, when you first start fly fishing and fly casting, you're taught that if you break your wrist, you lose stored energy in the rod on the back cast. And then when you come forward, it causes tailing loops, which in turn can create a bird's nest or knots in your leader or your tippet. That is true for the broken wrist, but at times, and the best example of this is when you're fishing streamers, let's say we make a cast 30 feet across the river, when you strip back and retrieve your fly, you have anywhere from 15 to 20 feet of fly line at your feet. And if you don't want a false cast above the wary trout, what you can do is bring your rod back to 2 o'clock and pause, and as your line, leader, and tippet is unrolling behind you, creep with your wrist back and then break your wrist to where your rod is now flat behind you, almost in streamline with the fly line. From that position with the broken wrist, all you have to do is roll the rod tip forward, abruptly stopping at 10 o'clock, let go of the line in your non-casting hand, and you can load and shoot 25 to 30 feet of line with one back cast. So that's where the broken wrist comes in play, where it can be productive, while other times it's not the best way to perform a cast.
Yeah, so maybe not when you're learning, but later on.
Right.
When, you're trying to achieve, yeah,
when they become addicted to streamers down the road, then they can use the broken wrist.
Yeah. Let's see. We had a follow-up from Sockeye Steve here when you were talking about the blue-wing olives.
Sure.
And he wrote in here on the internet, he says, Landon, thanks for the great info. Big help, bro. Same place, the black wing, only the blue wing olives. I don't know why I keep saying black. Blue wing olives only hatch for 20 minutes. They will not touch an emerger. There are none. So what part of the water column are the fish in, and how would you present to them because they are upset that there are no more pupas?
Right. Yeah, exactly. I don't like trout when they're upset. No, that's
yeah.
Challenge. Absolutely. I would definitely, if the trout are lifting to hit that hatch, and when they're doing that, if it only lasts 20 minutes, then concentrate on the lower, the deepest water column, because those fish will lift up when they lift and eat the hatch. Once the hatch disperses and there's no longer bugs, they'll typically go back to their main feeding zone. In addition to that, though, too, this is a situation, as we mentioned earlier in the program, start looking at unmatching the hatch as well, because I believe that trout, once they have the keen eyes to looking up, it's productive for them to lift for a hatch. If it's a sparse hatch and it doesn't last that long, they're still intrigued to look up. So you could throw something larger, whether it be an attractor, whether it be a hopper, whether it be something bigger or more obnoxious than the actual food supply itself. And a lot of times, bigger fish, too, since they are looking up in the column, they're not opposed to coming up and taking that bigger meal as long as they receive the nutrients back. So look deep if they're not lifting to the surface. If there are no mergers, concentrate on the nymphal state. If that doesn't help, then try unmatching the hatch to see if you can trigger those fish to lift back to the surface as well.
Okay. Another question on the Internet, Thomas Murphy in Redmond. If you are floating, assuming you mean floating in a boat, do you still sight fish or fish for certain types of water? I get sight fishing when wading, but that's tough enough. I guess he's wondering how you sight fish from a boat.
Right. Sight fishing from a boat, if you can sight fish from a boat, and I think the best example I use for this is a good friend of mine, Eric Mondrag, a guy from the Missouri River. Missouri being flat and fairly calm in its make and its flow, when we're moving down the water, if I see a fish, let's say in the side channel in a big back eddy, you may only get a glimpse of the fish as you float by and you're productively fishing. It's not uncommon to try to focus or target that water if you can back row into that area and then start to systematically deliver the fly. When you're sight fishing from a boat, you can't see the targets, and then just start looking for areas that you know with the cover, oxygen, and food supply. One of my favorite locations for this is structure next to the bank or even structure in the middle of the river, and the best example of that would be a large rock or boulder. Most of the large trout that I'll encounter in a river system, whether it's vast or narrow, will hold right in front of those structure points like boulders and rocks because there's that little washout pocket where they can simply rest, hold there, and wait for that food to be delivered. A lot of anglers are fooled to believe that it's the side of the rock all the time or behind the rock, but don't give up or look away from areas in front of the rock or even against the bank as well where they can find cover and feel safe.
Okay. Another kind of follow-up question from Dennis in Neshannock Station, New Jersey. He says, what flies do you suggest for spring runoff conditions?
Great question. So four patterns that I love to use during runoff when the flows are up and the fish are feeding and they're happy. One is a leech. Those are great imitations that wiggle and move in the water. A crane fly larva, which is a large meal that fish will chase knowing they're receiving the nutrients back. A San Juan worm or any type of worm imitation because we know those can leech in from the edge of the river. And then also egg patterns can work well. And it's funny that some anglers don't believe that eggs are effective, but I think that some trout in spring anticipate some of the color changes when they start seeing eggs and can come over and actively pursue it and start munching the next meal. And also scuds. So a fifth one to add to that, scuds or crustaceans, whether it's micey shrimp, a sow bug, or a scud, also great meals that can be ripped off the river bottom or from the edges, and fish will actively pursue those. High water like that is great because you can really go beyond just the worm for an attractor and use things like leeches and crane flies and scuds and sow bugs and find great success.
Okay. Another kind of follow-up question from Thomas Murphy. He says, how do you, quote, come back, quote, on a float?
Well, if you back row, so if you're drifting down, and it's not productive on fast waters where you have a swift current, like here on the Arkansas River, we have a fast gradient drop. But if you have water where you can back row after you fish through an eddy or a seam line, where you can come up the side channel, come up the back part of an eddy, and then redrift back in that area, or even if you can anchor to where you don't have swift currents pulling the boat off the anchor, then you can try to target those locations. And lastly, let's say you move down the water and you see a fish in a certain spot, just keep an eye on where that was, use a marker on the bank and know that a big fish is actively feeding there, and then come back to make a presentation moving on.
Okay, another question from the Internet. We've got an active audience tonight, Landon.
That's great.
Stirring them up. You're getting them thinking.
Great.
He says, do you ever use a drop shot method similar to Kelly Gallup's system?
I have used drop shots before, and the system like Kelly Gallup, it works well in fast, big, vast-moving waterways. a lot of times I find challenges with it as far as snagging and controlling my depth when we deal with a lot of tailwaters in Colorado. But Kelly's method in particular does work well in controlling depth. So I always encourage people, too, if you have a system or a technique like drop shot or Czech or European-style nymphing, standard nymph rates with or without indicators, always keep that on deck where it's a possibility to use. And one of the best ways that I will do that is I may have a Czech style nymph rig with a standard nymph rig and a streamer rig on three different rods, have them all rigged up for the trip and ready to transfer and change. That way I can have more access to fish and adapt and adjust for the depth of the water as well.
Yeah, I have, you know, I've heard so many methods from, you know, gosh, I've interviewed now over 200 guests on the shows here.
I know. Congratulations on that. That's great.
Yeah. That's because you were a part of the early start of this whole thing.
It was fun. Yes.
Yeah, but you know, everybody has all these methods, but when it comes down to it, is in the way that I've looked at it is, you know, go try them all and see what works best for you, because they all work. They obviously all work. It's like what works best for you and your method of fishing. And I think that's kind of the important thing to learn about that. But
it's huge, and the number one word for that is confidence. If you find a method or a system that works and you build confidence in that method, you can find great success. And making sure it's effective for your home waters or areas you typically fish is the other thing to look at. So you're right, trying it, trial and error. And Kelly, and you know, Kelly's a great individual, wonderful angler, and great streamer fisherman, and I really feel blessed to know he and John Barr and so many other great anglers over the year and see their methods and techniques. So always carry it with you. Give it a try on the water that you fish and just find the right method that will work for you.
Right. Okay, let's look at a chapter here, presenting to the trout. We've got several questions in that. Jim Bissell in Cincinnati says, it seems the fly fishing world is now caught up in specialized rods for every possible situation. I personally enjoy just casting and fishing one rod in all situations. Am I alone here?
He's not alone. It's a great, great question, and it's something that is, you know, very apparent in fly fishing because everything is so customized. Everybody's looking at the details of a presentation, how to be productive on various waters. I have clients show up that simply can't afford, or clients that show up and simply just only like to use one rod. And there's nothing wrong with that as long as you determine the right weight of the rod where you could adjust from dries to nymphs to streamers. And a good example of that may be a 6-weight to where it's heavy enough for streamer, heavy enough for nymphs, and also light enough if it's a supple tip where you can use dries as well. And I'm a big believer, and I work with great companies like Ross Reels and Able Reels, and Ross has started making their own rods as well with the RX, and they're coming out with a new prototype rod that's going to be on the market here in the next year. And those rods will vary in price and different lengths and sizes, and I think the biggest change that I've seen in our sport is the length of the fly rod, not so much the weight. Some of the rods now are 9 feet, 10 feet, 11 feet, and these are used for nymph rods even in tight quarters. So you can, by all means, stick with one rod. Just make sure that you keep the right weight to where you can adapt and adjust to different disciplines and then keep moving forward and being successful.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but when we're fishing for trout, generally that 5 or 6 weight would probably be your go-to rod, right?
It is. I would say
a little bit of everything.
Absolutely. And the 6 weight's really safe. I mean, you wouldn't always want to do this, but you could realistically take a 6-weight from the South Platte River and, you know, 2 months down the road you're fishing at Pyramid Lake, and then 5 months down the road you're fishing in Alaska. You may be undergunned in some of those scenarios like Pyramid Lake or up in Alaska or, you know, somewhere where you have larger fish and you may need an 8-weight, but at least with a 6-weight, it's a versatile rod where you have lifting power. You can still make a productive cast with heavy rigs and still be able to fight the fish. So 5 and 6, if you're dealing with standard river systems with average-sized trout, and then if you're moving up to larger trout or bigger waterways, then a 6-weight is the general purpose, a great way for a rod.
Yeah, and there are just some ends of the spectrum that just are not going to work for you, like maybe a 3-weight for streamers or a,
right, exactly.
You know, a 10 weight for you know, dry fly fishing. You know, I mean,
right,
there are
right.
boundaries that you can't kind of break.
Yeah, and that's a lot of that's based on the species of fish that you're going for. So general rule of thumb for trout is kind of what I'm referring to now with the 6
right.
weight. But if you bounce up and start doing some of the bigger fish with bigger flies, pike, muskie, some of the large, strong bass, and you want to go up. But always just use the recommendation you find with resources of information and match the species of trout with the weight of the rod to make sure that you're having the most production on your days that you're fishing.
Right, right. Rick Takahashi in Fort Collins wrote in, and Rick's been a guest on our show, and he's going to be a guest coming up again. We're going to talk about terrestrials, which is...
I love Tak. He's one of the nicest individuals you'll ever meet. He's a great guy.
Yeah, he is. And there's a, you know, a very accomplished fly fisherman who's almost always asks questions on almost every one of our shows. So, you know, that
That's
guy
right.
is learning. You know, he's like a sponge.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And learning everything he can, even though he's very accomplished, you know, himself. But
Absolutely.
His question is, at the end of your drift, prior to recasting your flies, nymphs, in this case nymphs, what do you like to do?
Great
How do you
question.
End your drift?
Absolutely. Great question. I would say that 90% of the time when I'm done drifting or if I have clients drifting in a run, I'll teach this at the beginning of the day. 90% of the drifts will be complete after you've allowed your flies to swing, but most importantly, you've twitched your flies, whether you twitch them up in the water column or twitch them to the side towards the bank you're standing on. The reason I believe in that so much, and we always call these fish on trips no-look fish, where you're looking upstream, you lift your rod, you start wading up, and then all of a sudden, boom, you have a fish on them, and it's a no-look. Well, those fish, what I believe happens sometimes, is they may be tracking your fly and performing what I refer to as the U-turn in the book, where they track the fly downstream. Once the fly makes the appearance of emerging or going out of view, the fish will make a U-turn, come over and slash the fly. So every drift will end, or majority of the drifts will end, with a swing and a twitch, just to see if that movement is enough to get the fish to take, or if it's enough to where the fish is tracking your fly, then it's really going to come over and crush it.
Good tip. Yeah, it's amazing how many fish you catch when you're fooling around.
Yeah.
Fly down.
Yeah, you're waiting and... your line's in the water, and you're like, oh, great, that's a great fish.
Trying to untangle your line and your reel or something, you know, and
exactly.
bam. You know.
Exactly.
Rick in Jackson, Wyoming, wrote in, and he says, when fishing a favorite area, I'm nymphing a run with a strong and steady wind blowing downstream. When casting from anywhere other than straight upstream, the wind puts a belly in the line downstream. It creates drag, and efforts to mend also get blown downstream. So any suggestions? Well, you should be an expert at fishing in the wind.
Yeah, I love these questions because we receive so much wind, just like you do back home as well. But, yeah, it's not uncommon in the spring that we can have 60 to 65-mile-an-hour gusts coming through that can almost deplete or eliminate a cast in a productive presentation. So when I'm delivering the mail or I'm teaching this to clients, I'm a big believer of using the cast where you're hammering the nail is the reference I use. So if you pick the rod up, stop at 12 o'clock, and then hammer the nail where you're coming all the way down. And most of the cast that we use in windy conditions, the rod tip will end just above the water surface to make sure that the plane and the projection of the rod tip is going down to the surface 45 degrees. If you do a few things, it might help with the cause of dealing with the wind. Number one is reaching to the right at the end of the cast or left, depending on what bank you're standing on, will give you a semi-aerial mend to where the rod is upstream of you, the tip of the rod, and then the projection of the fly line is down to the flies. The second thing that you can do is instead of standard mending where you perform a half circle with the tip of the rod, if you lift the rod just above the surface a foot or two, at a downstream angle pushing up, and you do small, short casts upstream, it's almost what we refer to as a shoot mend. It's like you're shooting fly line with the tip of the rod, and it only travels about 1 to 2 feet. But by making those small casts of fly line, you can shoot your fly line typically through the wind because you're close to the water surface and eliminate a lot of that drag.
Okay, okay. Another question from Gilbert in Johannesburg, South Africa. That's a bit on the other side of the world from us. We all have the same problems. And his problem is, how can I improve my wading? He says, I'm 6'4", and it always seems that the short guys run over the river, and I stumble along like a donkey. I thought bigger was better when wading.
I know, yeah, you're stable. Sometimes I'm jumping on the back of buddies that are 6'6", like, help me get through this water, I don't want to drown. But, no, so when you're wading, three things I teach clients on the water, especially when they feel unstable. First and foremost is the slide technique, to where when you're walking in the water, try to imagine that your feet are sliding through the water. So if you slide 1 foot upstream or directly in front of you, plant your foot and then slide your other foot to where it meets up with your same foot side by side, then you can make steps. And if you notice people that are flat-footed and seem very comfortable wading, a lot of times they're not picking their foot up and then bring it back down after the high step. They're sliding through the water with their boot almost 6 to 3 inches above the river bottom. The advantage to that, too, is that if you slide your feet, you typically can feel a rock or something in front of you if you bump it to prevent you from slipping. The other thing to do in shallow water when you're dealing with selective or wary trout is what I call a dive, where you're mimicking and matching what a bird like a blue heron would do. Lift 1 foot up on the edge of the river, and instead of planting your foot flat down on the surface, creating vibrations and disturbance, point your toe, dive your foot into the water, and then plant it on the river bottom, and that causes less disturbance, and you'll spook less trout and be more sure-footed.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure that the sliding, I'll have to try that next time I'm out, because I'm noticing as every year passes and I'm getting older, it's harder to wade. You know,
yes.
Your balance isn't as good as it once was when you were in your 20s, you know, and
right.
It gets harder for the older guys. So
it is.
Yeah.
Absolutely, and always be safe, too, and look at the river. Don't go against the current directly across, and don't go upstream. Also use the current to your advantage, to where if you're going to cross, position yourself upstream an extra 5 or 10 steps if possible. And then as you're sliding your feet, you're going to glide with the current downstream semi as you're moving across, and that creates less resistance and allows you to be more stable instead of trying to fight the current with your thighs.
Yeah, yeah. And probably, you know, from personal experience, I know on the Roaring Fork I did this once where it was a tough way to cross, but the wade back became even tougher.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
They weren't equal in the challenge. And the way
right.
back, I had to go get a branch off a
yep.
tree to make it across, because it was much different coming the opposite direction.
Oh, yeah.
And
don't be afraid of a wading staff. Some people are embarrassed to admit they use a wading staff, and I carry 2 wading staffs with me at all times on trips and encourage people to use them, especially now with the makes and models. A good example of this would be Sims wading staff that you can attach to your belt. It collapses and it's out of view, and then when you need it, pull it out, whip it in front of you, and just make sure that you're sure-footed in the ground. Fish Pond also makes another great wading staff. Always keep that in mind when you're dealing with fast currents, and don't be afraid to use a wading staff at any time.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we kind of answered Doug's question about casting into the wind. Final chapter in your book is tough landings.
Oh, yeah.
You're talking about landing fish. Rick Takahashi, again, from Fort Collins, wants to know, what landing net do you favor for all your all-around guiding?
Great question. So I was always, for years, a big fan of wooden nets with soft mesh. And while I do still love a wooden net and have the craftsmanship it takes to make it, a lot of times they'll only last one season. So my go-to net over the last 3 or 4 years is the Nomad nets from Fish Pond with the Ghost Net basket, which is, there's an advantage and disadvantage. The advantage to their nets is that they're indestructible, being that they're carbon fiber nets. And when you have the indestructible net, it's great because you can always use it with success. But the other thing to remember, the ghost net baskets a lot of times are not deep enough for bigger fish. So if need be, at times I'll change out the basket to an oversized ghost net to make sure that I can net the fish. But fish ponds, nomad nets by far, I think are the most productive nets on the market now, ones to really stick with.
Okay, and then one final, I want you to throw in, I don't have a question for you, I just want you to throw in a tip about landing big trout that you can share with folks.
Sure. So the biggest thing that I deal with on the water when anglers are fighting trout is not so much the hook set, because that can be adapted and adjusted daily, but it's knowing how to not reach the breaking point. And my personal example of this is if you lift on a trout, you want to apply maximum pressure to tire the fish out. And most large trout will tire out by head shaking and moving their whole body, expending energy. If you apply a convex bend where the rod from the cork handle forms a rainbow to the tip of the rod, and you're lifting the rod in front of you with your arm, that's a convex bend where you apply maximum pressure from the strongest point of the fly rod, which is the first 3 feet. From that position, if the trout bolts to the other side of the river, you can point the rod at the fish, let the reel do its job. If the fish gets wily and goes in reverse towards the bank you're standing on, you can bring your rod vertical and still maintain leverage and pressure. If you have a vertical bend directly above you, where you can't see the tip of the rod, if the fish does a bolting run or a powerful head shake, when the rod can't flex anymore, all the pressure goes down to the tippet, and that's what I refer to as the breaking point. So that convex bend allows your arm to become a shock absorber, and then you can fight fish knowing that you're not going to reach the breaking point.
Okay, great. Great tip. And one final question from Robin, Pennsylvania, and this is for all the people who maybe just getting started in fly fishing. He says, I've always been a spin fisherman, and I'm trying to transition to fly fishing only. Good move, in my mind. Give me some advice on how not to get frustrated when first starting out, that would be great.
Absolutely. Great question, and it's nice to hear that somebody's transferring over to fly fishing. And remember this, too. You also might have an advantage because many conventional anglers, a lot of the individuals we see, for example, using tube jigs, have a great deal of knowledge and understanding about depth control and also color change to trigger fish to take. I would think a good transition for you, if you're using conventional, let's say if it's lures, try going directly to streamers on the fly rod so you automatically have knowledge that you can transfer between using the method and using different disciplines. When you do that and you get into fly fishing, just remember that it's not always productive fishing. There's going to be breaks and periods where you're not going to get fish taking your fly, but you're always learning. And just really allow yourself to evolve similar to what you probably did with your conventional rigs. But I think that transfer, I recommend that a lot. If somebody was using lures, go straight over to streamers. That way you have that knowledge and that connection as you move forward in fly fishing. And congratulations to you. I hope you find great success, and watch out because it's highly addictive sport.
Yeah, it sure is. That's why we're all here.
That's right.
Well, we need to wind it up here, Landon. But that was a busy night. You put out a lot of information, that's for sure. So stick with me here
for
a few more minutes.
Well,
don't go away yet because we're going to give away your book here in a minute. And
excellent.
I might need your help in determining whether we get the right answer or not. And we're also going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So stick around for a few more minutes, and don't forget, you have that chance to win Trout Tips by Landon Mayer, and courtesy of Stackpole Books, so hang with us. A mining company called Pack Rim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. The Chewitna Coal Project would be the first project in Alaska history to mine directly through salmon habitat, the Chewitna River drainage, 11 miles of it. Critical commercial, sport, and subsistent fishing economies would be permanently destroyed. Pack Rim says it can rebuild a salmon stream, but scientific experts can find no example where successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. Chewitna Coal would be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. It's time to stop the Chewitna Coal strip mine, and for more information on how you can help, go to inletkeeper.org. That's inletkeeper.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find the link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on the link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. And now it's time to give away some prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from this show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show. You don't want to miss out on your chance to some of these great prizes we have to offer. If you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show and provide you with information on how to receive your gift. So the first thing we're going to give away tonight is a membership, a one-year membership, to the Federation of Fly Fishers. If you want to learn more about the Federation of Fly Fishers, go to fedflyfishers.org. They are an international organization and deal with both freshwater and saltwater. So we have a winner, and it's Lorne Young. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but Lorne, you know who you are in British Columbia. So congratulations on the membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. Yeah. And so our next giveaway is a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, courtesy of Amato Books. Great publisher. They're going to have a lot of books and periodicals. If you want to check them out and what they have, go to AmatoBooks.com. So AmatoBooks.com. And our winner there is Craig Myers. Craig Myers in Oregon.
Congratulations.
So, yeah, congratulations to Craig as well. We've got quite the people all over the country here and world tonight. So it's always
great.
Nice
That's
to have that. So now we got that done. Let's give away Landon's book, and I'm gonna clear my queue because we still got questions coming in, Landon. I could probably be here all night. So, it's the same queue that I take the answers in. So Trout Tips by Landon Mayer, Stackpole Books, the publisher. To learn more about Stackpole, go to stackbooks.com, stackpolebooks.com. They're a great publisher of many great fly fishing books.
And also Headwater Books as well, too. Stackpole and Headwater Books both were in collaboration on that book, so they're both great companies.
Okay. Okay, great, great. And so, question. Two-part question. I need two answers. The first part of the question is, what percentage of fish does Landon usually, is he sight fishing to? I had asked him and ventured a guess. So what percentage does he sight fish to, and what is his go-to strike indicator? What's his go-to strike indicator? So those are the two questions.
Great question.
To make it somewhat difficult for them. Oh, now we've got some sharp guys and gals out there. That, and Treg, you're so good. I can't help it. This guy, Treg Owings, do you know Treg, Landon?
I think I've met him before.
Up in Moscow, Idaho. Anyway, you know, he's won more stuff off our shows because he's fast and...
Oh, that's cool.
Great note taker or great number two, but Treg, you've won again. What can I say? And
congratulations!
I can see the big Cheshire grin on his face right now. You know? I just hope he uses all these great books and prizes he wins. So you better be a damn good fly fisherman, Treg. We meet up one of these days. We're gonna test your skills out. So.
I hope you enjoy the book. I hope you enjoy it.
Yeah, so congratulations, Treg. Again, send me your information because I don't keep it around. You know the routine. And Thomas, you were right behind him, Thomas Murphy in Redmond. You were just a second or so off. That's how close these things are. So, but anyway, congrats. And to everybody that won tonight, I'm glad. Hope you enjoy your prizes. And I know this Trout Tips is a great book. If you didn't win, which everybody didn't win except for Treg tonight, be sure to go out to Amazon and get this. Oh, Landon, what's your website? We didn't talk about what's
you bet. You bet. So you can get the book on the website, too, 101 Trout Tips, The Guide, Secrets, Tactics, and Techniques, and you can get that from LandonMayer.com, L-A-N-D-O-N, MAYER.com. And you can also find me on Facebook, Landon Mayer Fly Fishing on Facebook. You get a chance like that. And then also on Instagram, Landon Mayer Fly Fishing. So it'd be hashtag Landon Mayer Fly Fishing.
Okay. I'm just writing this down. Okay. So good, good. And, yeah, and if you want to fish the South Platte, you need a good guide, give a shout out to Landon, and he's one of the best in the state here for that. So be sure to keep him in mind. Well, thanks, Landon, for being on the show again tonight. I think this is like our fourth show with you, and I always appreciate your knowledge. And thank you for sharing all your knowledge with us. It's an incredible gift, and we surely appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, and I do believe that giving back is what makes this great sport grow. So always be happy to come back and help you guys out anytime. Thanks again.
Okay, thanks, Landon. Well, hopefully you've all found our archive on our website. If you haven't, if you're new to askaboutflyfishing.com, check it out at the bottom of our homepage and links on every page. There's links to our archive. There's over 200 shows now we've done and that are in our archive, from trout to tarpon to the Madison River to Mako shark fishing in San Diego. So check it out and use the keyword search. You're going to find all kinds of great shows to listen to. Our next broadcast is going to be on April 15th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, I'm going to interview Bob Romano. And our topic for the show will be fly fishing the Rangeley Lakes region of Maine, upstate Maine, great area. And Bob has fished Rangeley Lakes region for more than 25 years. It's got pocket water streams, tail waters, and lakes. He knows it well and will share where to go and how to fish this incredible destination in Maine. We'd like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Stackpole Books, Front Range Anglers, Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska, and Keeney's Fly Shop for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673. That's 800-985-1673. And we'd be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future podcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.